And the heart center will accept gladly help of both the mind and the hand. But the heart center is where the actual baptism, the actual mystery of the Pentecostal experience is accorded to the being or the living person. Therefore, the heart center in man represents his spirituality, his essential and real spirituality. And this heart center is where the record or the true and faithful report of his virtues, where this record begins to result in the development of growth of this archetypal soul symbol. This is a little obscure and difficult, but there's not too much you can say about some of these things, because again, they can only be known by a sort of mystical experience itself. The field of the heart is called by Beni a kind of earth. And if the earth be good, then the heart is nourished by that goodness. The seed unfolds and grows. And the mystery of immortality is attained as an experience in the inner consciousness of man himself. The next point that perhaps we can do a little something with is to study a little more carefully this relationship of the heart to the body itself. We can do this by means of an analogy to the solar system. The heart in the body is surrounded by a group of organs. These organs, according to the Babylonians, Chaldeans, Greeks, Romans, practically every civilized people, have always been associated with the planets. Paracelsus makes this very definitely an assertion. Namely, that the organs surrounding the heart resemble the planets surrounding the sun. Consequently, the organs themselves become secondary deities. They are the secondary powers by means of which the pure life energy of the heart is distributed through the system for a certain purpose. We have three energies with which to consider, each of them, however, being a kind of specialization of basic energy. The pure energy of consciousness forms the mysterious sea of life in which all other forms of consciousness have their existence. This is the pure energy of the sun, which is totally invisible. This is the pure energy of life in all things. And the ultimate of this life is its own eternal, unconditioned fertility. Pythagoras of Samos said that every conceivable unit of life is seminal or seed-like. Therefore, that life is an eternal substance, everywhere existent, like a mysterious invisible ocean or fluid, or air, or gas, or essence, that no place can be deficient of it in any way, and that this pure life, which has no form, no appearance that we can see, no nature we can define, no direct processes that we can understand, this pure life alone is good. This pure life is the only reality that exists. This pure life in its unconditioned state is the mysterious, intangible fact by which all things exist, and without which cannot be fashioned anything that is made. This pure life is absorbed in its own production, so that created things are aware of creation, but they are not aware of the life in which creation continually exists. Thus we may see the plant growing from the dark earth, but the dark earth is invisible to us. We may perceive that the plant gains innumerable energies and powers from this dark earth, but this dark earth does not seem to resemble any of its powers. We look at the beautiful rose rising from the earth. We cannot see the rose in the earth. We cannot understand how the dark soil could produce so great a mystery out of itself. Yet it is the energy of the darkness that gave us this beauty of the revealed and apparent form. Thus, in philosophy particularly, we recognize that all natures of themselves are sustained by one nature, of which we have no definition. This dark soil does not, however, produce identities from itself. This dark soil produces different flowers, different forms of life. It produces everything from the most glorious of all forms to the most humble and even obnoxious of all weeds. This soil, therefore, causes all things to bear their fruitfulness according to their own natures. Yet its energy is the one life by which all natures are able to attain to the condition of living. Therefore, this soil, this earth, this energy, this mystery is the mother of all living. This is the eternal life, forever conditioned, by which all good and all ill come into being. Yet this life itself is not visibly similar to any of the things which it produces, nor can its nature be determined by a study of its productions. The only thing that we can finally decide is that its nature must be sufficient to sustain all production, and that this in no way shall be regarded as exhausting that nature, for it must produce all production within the sensory grasp of man, an innumerable and inevitable production which man does not understand or cannot perceive. So here we have this basic life, this basic vitality, which is brought to man as the very substance upon which his life must depend. This life becomes then the vitalizer of innumerable specialized function. And everything that exists must have a sensitized area of some nature, must have some means of drawing this life to itself, focusing this life upon itself, inasmuch as the entire growth of the particular life is dependent entirely upon it developing in and from this basic energy. It follows from this that we may liken this energy now to the dark earth, and we may liken the consciousness of a being or a creature to any one of the innumerable plants or forms of life that grow out of this earth. The oak tree and the willow tree, the pine tree and the elm, all have this common source of energy, yet each becomes what it is, but only because this energy is present. So consciousness becomes the universal symbol because it represents the only conceivable power which can be all things to all creatures. Every other kind of specialization must be deficient in something. So we give the term consciousness to that which is capable of expression through infinite diversity, and yet itself remains forever the same. That which produces difference from sameness. Now, the reason it can do this is because through the vast vistas of consciousness, infinite orders of life are evolving. These evolving orders of life are developing from these seeds, which are spiritual focal areas. And an infinite evolution is continually specializing the units of eternal life itself. So man, being a person with an intellectual existence, and according to philosophy, with an existence prior to this world, and an existence after or subsequent to departure from this world, man is a personal being with his roots in universal consciousness. He is a personal being nourished by an impersonal principle in which he exists. Now, this universal impersonal principle is everywhere. But if the particular aspects of that consciousness are in some way separated from a structure, that structure passes into a state of disintegration. Therefore, the integration of the structure depends upon the maintenance of the organization of it in relationship to its life source. If, therefore, the root of the tree is injured, the whole tree will die. And if the taproot, so to say, of man's existence is injured, then man no longer tunes in or receives the benefit of this universal life in which he exists. He is then like the proverbial sailor on the ocean, surrounded by water and with nothing to drink. This means that if the adjustment between his own structure and this universal energy is not maintained, then he is no longer supplied with this energy. But he becomes a dead thing floating in the very life that supported him. This concept was also rather well brought out by very ancient people. In order that man as a being, as a particular creature, unfolding his own composite nature, may therefore have his roots in the life which is essential to him, the heart becomes the instrument of this rooting. It is because of the fact that the heart is capable of receiving and focusing or serving as a channel or medium for the bringing into the body of certain phases of universal energy that man can function as a being, just as though it was possible to turn an electric current into a wire. And by so doing, this wire now becomes suitable to be a telephone. The wires may be there, but if the current is not, nothing happens. The body may be here, but if it's linked to the peculiar universal energy by which it is sustained, if this is missing, then the body is not alive. It has another kind of life. It has a molecular life, but it does not have the kind of life that we know. And as man, as a being, cannot exist consciously in a body contrary to his own inward adjustment, man cannot inhabit the body if life as a principle departs from it. I think then we have to recognize two persons in our problem. One is this universal person who supplies energy, or which is energy. And the other is the individual person who is evolving as the plant or any other creature in nature evolves because of the abundant supply of energy to make this evolution possible. Thus, we may definitely affirm that the heart does have two distinct functions, one represented by its core function and the other by its peripheral function. Its core and essential function being to serve as the intermediary or a catalyzing agent between space and manifestation. And the other is that it shall serve as a kind of throne for what we term the ego, or the consciousness of the evolving being that has moved into this environment. In other words, in the heart must also be the archetype of the form that is to develop from the heart, not only in terms of physical appearance, but in terms of mental, emotional, and psychical existence. Thus, it would appear that Behme is not entirely incorrect when he declared that the spirit in man, the personal spirit, which is himself, abides within the heart, that this is its holy house. And in this place, the spirit itself worships at the altar of the Most High God, the Most High God being the mysterious power which is greater than itself, which is the life principle upon which it subsists. From this spirit core of individual existence, the essential state or nature of the being that is now incarnated begins the unfoldment of its own character, a process which begins at the time of quickening, a time in which the personal being, the entity, takes over the administration of the body, and then begins the process of adapting the entire mystery provided by universal life to the needs of the personal existence. Man can control a very large part of his own function. But with the exception of a few very highly specialized individuals, man cannot consciously control the beat of his own heart. If man had this as a voluntary function with his present state of evolution, he would probably forget it one of these days and drop dead. But as a result of the fact that he cannot do this, we have another symbolic situation, namely that the fact of life itself is not directly available to man, that this fact is imparted by something superior, that the beating of the heart or the maintenance of the relationship between energy and the function of the body is not primarily under the keeping of man himself. Man may destroy the instrument, or by a very long process of deterioration, wreck the instrument. He may, by intensities of his attitudes, so condition it that it can no longer function properly. But all that man can do to the pulse beat is interfere with it. He has no power to cause it. It began when he was not conscious of his own existence. It continues frequently long after he loses consciousness of his own existence. Or it may stop suddenly. But in any event, it is not something that man himself can control. It is the one link between himself and the infinite, in which the infinite still holds all the cards. Which is probably highly suitable, because man is not capable of handling this situation at his present state of growth. So every part of man's life, according to the old mystics, is under the sovereignty of his will, except the pulse point in the heart, is subject only to the motion of the infinite. Consequently, man has a continual a promise, a pact, or contract with the infinite, represented by the pulse beat. This is like the rainbow that appeared to Noah. It is a covenant between the infinite and man. For as long as the pulse beats, the infinite is with man. And when man, by some reason or other, separates himself from the infinite, the pulse ceases. Now, the principal cause, of course, of this separation is the gradual exhaustion of the structure of the body and its ability to continue to respond to this sensitive beat. Gradually, situations set in which the individual, by age and so forth, loses the power to control the functions of the body. And when the crystallization or the general deterioration reaches the point in which the pulse can no longer respond to the beat, the individual ceases to exist physically, not as a being, but as a body. So man now finds himself standing forever in the presence of a mystery. A mystery as great as that which he faces when he gazes out on a starry sky at night. He is suddenly in the midst of a vastness. And all this vastness that is not his own personal self is brought into rapport with him. And he partakes of this vastness because of the heartbeat. This is his true relationship with the infinite. Most mystics have sensed this and realized it, and have therefore turned to this mysterious altar of the heart, on which burns the mysterious flame of everlastingness. It has become one of the greatest of all symbols of the infinite, because it is in this symbolism that man sees the ever-presence of his God. And any man who is able to be still will know, because if we are very quiet, we can hear the beating of the drum of life. The old peoples all held this conviction. Out of this supply, we gain, therefore, a sense of nutrition also. Whereas the body is sustained outwardly by its participation in the great nutritional areas of human maintenance, the energy of things, so nutrition is inwardly provided by this mysterious pulse beat. But the nutrition we take in has no direct effect upon the pulse beat. The only thing it affects is the physical structure, which, if it is starved or inadequately fed, can no longer react to the beat of the heart. Or if by impoverishment of nutrition the heart muscle is impoverished to a certain degree, then it may not be able to respond and the person dies. But the nutrition does not support the heartbeat. The nutrition only makes possible the maintenance of the body, so that the beating of the heart may be a normal and proper function. So man has his own personality to consider, and behind that personality, this X quantity, this mystery, from which he can never escape while he is here. This energy also provides him with the means of unfolding the temperament which he has. This energy, becoming specialized, supports all of the processes of his growth and attainment. In its various aspects, it becomes mental energy and physical energy. It provides the necessary psychic communion by which the entire personality is bound into one being. This one being, however, is a magnificent superstructure built over a tiny little pulse beat, by which its existence and survival is measured. Everything that is dependent is less than that upon which it depends. This was an ancient oracle of wisdom. Man is completely dependent on the pulse. Therefore, the pulse must represent a link between man and something infinitely greater than man, and an infinite relationship to all beings. This pulse beat, the ancients sensed or believed that they saw in the mysterious flickering of the stars. It was a symbol of this universal agitation or vibration everywhere present in nature. Once the heart situation, then, receives its understanding, we can perhaps liken it even more to a temple and to a shrine. We can liken it to Solomon's everlasting house, or to one of the mysterious shrines in Asia, such as the beautiful temples of the Dilwara, of the Jain sect, or the wonderful mysterious cave temples of Hyderabad, or on the island of Elephanta, or the Temple of Heaven in Peking, or one of the great mosques of the Muslim world, such as the Jumna Masjid at Delhi in India. All of these buildings become now symbols of the heart. For to them, men turn to commune with a spirit, a power. In ancient times, this power was in the form of a flame, guarded forever upon an altar in the adytum of the temple. This flame was guarded by the priests and vestals and was never permitted to go out, for it was the symbol of the eternal covenant between God and man. The flame itself flickered like the pulse. It was a mysterious livingness. Fire was an element that seemed as mysterious as life itself, and was anciently identified with life. The person becomes the high priest of this sanctuary, and man as a being, as an ego, as a personality, an individuality, was anciently regarded as being permitted by purification and by rites of regeneration and repentance to finally enter into the sanctum of the temple, and there to bow before the mystery of the eternal flame, which is the pulse. And in this he prayed, or became possessed by the spirit of a great veneration. And this became the very process of mystical enlightenment. And in every part of the world, it was assumed that the mystic, seeking truth, always sought it by entering into his own heart. This was his secret house. This was his temple, his shrine, his palace. This was the place where God came and dwelt with men. And the sanctification of a temple and the rites still used in the sanctifying of a church are based upon all these ancient convictions. Once having come into the living mystery of this, it was assumed that the heart then became the basis of a mysterious direction of the septenary of man's psycho-emotional life. In other words, the heart, having been established as the sanctuary, the individual then, having dedicated this sanctuary to the one living God, setting it aside as a holy place unto the Most High, then proceeded to go forth as the initiate or adept being in the service of this consciousness and in the glorification of it, in the mysteries of the Holy Grail. This mysterious heart symbol was the Sun Grail, which also, of course, in some of the older legends, was the Sangre Real, the mysterious cup that carried the blood of the king. This strange symbolism also, the symbol of the precious blood, the symbol of the cleansing blood, all had to do with the purification of the body by the blood moving into the presence of the life, where it received an ordination of life, where it passed through this tremendous vibratory focus of universal life and impregnated with it, went forth again to the works of life, mainly the ministry, which was the distribution of energy through the bloodstream. The heart was therefore the one sacred symbol, the symbol of the entire integration of the universe around a spiritual principle. This principle being known particularly as the heart power. Now, ancient man became more or less of the understanding that the heart power represented a kind of divine fact. Akhenaten, the great Egyptian mystic, seems to have sensed this long before most other civilized human beings had attained to this concept. Namely, that this mysterious heart power, the life, the true life, was of itself life-giving, but that man was life-destroying. That this life, therefore, came forth, having been born in a manger, and this again is only a symbol of the heart itself, because in the ancient times the inn, or the place of rest, was also called the heart. This symbol was to the effect that man, by deviating from the laws of this heart principle, gradually destroyed his religion. He had to perform a sacrilegious act, and the sacrilegious act, the final, unforgivable sin, that ill which could never be forgiven, was the sin of letting the fire go out, death. And this fire had to go out for some reason. Now, this does not mean that the ancient immediately conceived physical immortality. He knew the true meaning of sin, which is not evil, but to fall short, inadequacy. But he did realize that when the individual in any way perverted the power of this energy so that it turned and became an enemy of itself, then he was committing a very great and terrible sacrilegious act. So Akhenaten gave us this realization that those who have become aware of the matchless altar of the heart and who have stood or knelt in the presence of the flame have become its servants, and therefore that they must gradually bring the entire unit of life existence into harmony with the laws of the flame. For this flame will either illumine or it will consume. And this mysterious heat power of the pulse will either bring light or combustion, according to the nature of the material which serves as its fuel or serves as its focal substance in this world. Thus, this light on life is forever burning out or removing corruption. The mystics held, therefore, that those who believed in the ultimate universal reality of life were required to so live and so conduct themselves that this flame in the heart was protected and preserved against anything that was bad for it. And anything that was bad for it would ultimately break up the focal point and cause the fire to go out. They also realized that anything that was bad for the flame or hazarded the flame in the heart was also contrary to the good of the evolving person or entity which was depending upon this heart and was the priest of its altar. So anything that injured the heart, flame, was bad for the evolving entity that was depending upon this energy for its own evolution. To preserve its relationship to life, this entity must preserve its relationship to value. And out of this came perhaps one of the earliest concepts of ethics. Ethics was not based upon right and wrong in the terms of ordinary human concept. Ethics might be measured by a final circumstance. Did it cause the flame to go out? Anything that destroyed the contact, willfully and intentionally, or deprived the individual of full participation in this vital life principle, was bad. That was the actual source of the concept of evil. And anything that was bad for the life was bad for the person in the body. Gradually, therefore, man sought, through purification, through regeneration, through idealization, to live a more beautiful and perfect life, in order that this energy in its function might attain a maximum diffusion. And by this maximum diffusion would provide the best of the qualities of energy for all purposes of the evolving being. If this confusion persisted, then the energy necessary to think or to feel or to act or to perform any sensory function or any process or task, the energy was diminished. And it was discovered in early times that any evil that man performed struck directly at the heart, and that therefore it affected the pulse point or the pulse beat, the pacemaker. And wherever this occurred, it meant that man was interfering with his own participation in universal life. He was, in a sense, also discrediting or desecrating this life which must come into manifestation through the vehicles created by evolving beings. It's a little complicated, but here we have the secret of the Eucharist. Here we also have the secret of the Last Supper. We have the secret of the Eucharistic rites among non-Christian peoples. For here we have the participation by the whole nature represented by the 12, for they constitute the zodiacal band or the hypothetical dodecahedron of Pythagoras, which constituted the full structure of the universe, or the total nature of any being, was 12. Therefore, in this case, the disciples, partaking of the bread and the wine, are partaking of the basic life power. And when they destroy, or permit to be destroyed, the high priest of this mystery, they destroy their own participation in this life power. They betray it. And if they betray it, it is taken from them. So in the mystical orders of the quest, the great orders of chivalry in the Middle Ages, the heart doctrine became the symbol of virtue. For virtue has as its final end quietude. And quietude means the free power of the pulse beat to maintain its rhythms and to function ever more perfectly. Because the heart muscle is not made toxic by the psychic and psychological pressures of the individual. Thus, the cleanliness of mind and body, exemplified in the ancient rituals, guaranteed the maximum manifestation of the eternal in man. Now, the ancients philosophized on this quite extensively. They pointed out that the heart dweller, by which they meant essentially now this energy, it was never a moralizer in itself. It never told anybody what to do. But it revealed that if they did certain things, it hurt. There is no dogmatism. There is simply law and the breaking of law. Not by covenant or code as we understand it, or by legislation, but simply by the fact that there are rules in space governing the distribution of energy. If these rules are broken, the energy fails the individual who breaks the rules, because he has primarily failed the energy. All of this centers in the heart concept, and it was gradually recognized that the heart, under certain conditions, could also become a more joyous, a more ample and suitable place. Just as from the first rude stone monuments and runic pillars of old time, there have gradually developed the beautiful churches and chapels that we know today. Men's places of worship were once rude altars in the wilderness. Today, they are magnificent in appearance, if only the true inner mystery of them could be more fully understood. But the heart becoming this nobler mansion that we are continuously building, we know that by certain definite processes, we may bring greater vibratory adjustment to the heart. We know that every cell in the body changes gradually over a period of years, that new orders of life come into being in our bodies every few minutes. If, therefore, through certain processes, constructively and devoutly adhered to, through these processes, the heart is strengthened. The heart structure is refined and improved by intent rather than by the simple processes of growth. And nearly all the processes which make for the happiness of the heart are processes of kindliness, friendliness, charity, and goodness. That with these faculties, with these factors, the heart itself relaxes and becomes peaceful, and becomes instinctively more immediately responsive to this pulse beat that is constantly continuing there. Now let us assume for a moment that we have followed this line of thought. We have seen the invisible power represented by the altar with the flame. We have seen the hierophant of this mystery, the human ego, the high priest of this mystery cult, man as a being focused in the temple of his heart. We know that man only under certain conditions is permitted to enter into the presence of the Most High, these conditions being those of disciplined meditation and the most highly evolved, specialized doctrines of the wisdom religion. Also, we realize that the time naturally comes when, as the Muslim says, each man must unwind his own shroud. Here, of course, you all remember the Muslim wears a white cloth twisted around his head called a turban. This is his shroud. He wears it all his life, and he will be wrapped in it when he dies. So as one Muslim mystic says in one of his stories, he knew his time was coming because his heart was whispering goodbye. It was a very poetic thought, but this is the concept underlying it all. The time comes when the body is no longer suitable to maintain the needs of the being. The being is not yet wise enough and strong enough to preserve this body. Someday, perhaps it can do so for an indefinite period of time. But the whole way of life will have to change. So the time comes when the pulse archetype tells us that energy is going to move away. Psychologically, we seem to be aware of this. And here again, the direct awareness seems to arise from the actual agitation of the pulse itself, long before it actually ceases. Man becomes some way mysteriously aware that the transition is to occur. He hears the voice saying farewell. In this time, finally, the energy fields, gradually depleted, are no longer able to sustain the being that is now dwelling in this vitalized area. So the being, possessing its faculties and its septenaries of powers, then begins to draw into itself as the ego or personal integration center, draw in all of its sub-department heads, its managers and its clerks and its superintendents and even a few office boys, which are fast vanishing. They are now called vice presidents. And in this situation, the heart gradually gathers into itself all of these elements until finally they have come to be one unit and the ego has enfolded back into itself again. In a sense, this lotus flower of the entity has closed mysteriously, like the lotus itself closes at night in the darkness of death. By this time, the pattern is becoming very definite within the nature. It has become obvious that this separation must take place. Then the process begins, which in a simple physiological way is simply this retiral up the mysterious left branch of the vagus, in which, having finally gathered its own powers, the ego, the incarnating being, moves out because it has found that it can no longer function adequately. It can no longer be itself, so it must depart, as Socrates himself predicted. So it goes up through the vagus, finally enters the great central hall of the brain, where, incidentally, the judgment of the soul takes place in the great mysterious twin pillared hall of truth. And finally ascends through the thousand-petal lotus, the Brahmarandra, and goes out through the crown of the head, and returns to the decarnate state which it previously occupied. In other words, it retires from objectivity to subjectivity. This does not necessarily mean, however, that the old energy, the pulse maker, has ceased. This universal life may still be there. And we know many instances, and we constantly come across them, where a person is medically and scientifically alive, but unable to function, unable to even be conscious, but may drift along for a little while in a state of deep coma. In this case, where once the separation has been made, even the physician says it is only a matter of hours, a matter of minutes, we do not know. But still the heart is beating. But the heart is beating against an ever-losing game. But it very often happens that the heart continues to beat for a time after the entity has actually departed. I believe originally this was probably intended. But in the course of ages, the situation has become so complicated by artificial circumstances that nature's essential pattern is now difficult to discern. I think nature intended the heart to continue to beat until certain psychological experiences had been accomplished by the entity in disassociation. But now that is not always the case. But in any event, theoretically, the heart slowly flutters down, and the altar flame on the heart goes out. When this happens, then it simply means that this bridge or link has ceased to function, and the infinite life simply goes on, waiting for the day, of course, when the bud again will appear upon the surface of the waters. But it is a very quiet procedure. That which remains then is the body, which will slowly vanish or disintegrate into its natural substances, and this great sea of existence which goes on. Now, the life which animated has not changed. The thing that was animated is going back again into the subtle substances of being to be resolved into innumerable forms when other potters take the clay. Nothing has essentially changed. Time and eternity remain. But it is this mysterious life that continues unchanged due to regardless of the changes of form and circumstance that Buddha used as the final symbol of his nirvana. His nirvana was this life itself, this eternal allness to which everything must turn, upon which everything must depend, the mysterious real axis of the wheel of illusion. So that finally, there is only this life principle animating all things, bestowing upon them the mystery of their own existence, ultimately resolving their existence back into itself again, and remaining in the end the only thing that is. This is the existence in itself, and the altar of the heart is its manifestation in man. A manifestation of which it may be truly said, the Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. The Lord brings the flame, the Lord takes the flame. And we can slur it a little and say, law for Lord. And we shall have the same essential principle, that this is the power that the infinite bestows of its own infiniteness, and which it returns again to itself by its own means. A man's heart stands as the symbol of this before the world of generations in which he exists. Time's up.